muted.
Hello, and welcome to the Heathrow SP Limited half-year results presentation. Throughout this call, all telephone participants will be in listen-only mode, and afterwards, there will be a question-and-answer session. And just to remind you, this call is being recorded. I'm now pleased to hand you over to Colin Matthews, CEO. Please begin.
Thank you, and good afternoon, and welcome to this presentation to discuss the 2013 half-year results for Heathrow SP Limited. I'm Colin Matthews, Heathrow's Chief Executive. With me, you can see on my left here, José Leo, our CFO, Andrew Effiong, Director of Treasury, and Anne Hearn, our Head of Debt Investor Relations. For those of you on the call, I recommend you view the presentation via the online link. It was provided in the invitation issued for this event and repeated in this morning's press release. Today's results and this presentation are available at the Investor Center on our website, which is heathrowairport.com. We'll be happy to take questions at the end of the presentation. I'll now turn to the highlights for the first 6 months of 2013. I'm very pleased to report continuing good progress along the familiar themes that I've laid out quarter after quarter for some considerable time. Record levels of passenger satisfaction have combined with strong traffic numbers, up 2.4%, to give an 18% increase in EBITDA. You can see some of the key numbers on the table on this chart. José will run through the financial numbers in more detail in a moment. There are also three very obvious strategic topics that we're tackling day by day. For some reason, they all have one letter and one digit. T2 being the first, Terminal 2, the Queen's Terminal, Q6 the second, the regulatory cycle, and finally, R3, or our plans over expansion at Heathrow. I'll touch briefly on each of those. I'll start on passenger satisfaction. Of course, you can measure this in different ways, and the way we tend to look at it is the externally produced third-party data, Airport Service Quality, or ASQ. This data comes out once a quarter. It came out 24 or 48 hours ago, I think. And you can see on the top left how that's trended since 2006, with Heathrow being the line which started off well below average and is now touching on top quartile amongst European airports. That's obviously great progress, and we're keen to continue that. On the right-hand side, it shows where that puts us against other European airports. And by the color coding, you can pick out the most obvious direct competitors of ours, which are the other big hub airports across Europe. And you can see we are close to the lead, well ahead of the others. Another simple way of measuring it is a few years ago, back in 2007, less than half of passengers rated their experience at Heathrow as being excellent or very good. That's four or five on a scale of one to five. And today, that's more than three-quarters. And as I've said already, we're keen for that to continue that trend, and we're proud of the trend that we've established. Along with that strong passenger service score, we've had strong passenger numbers. You know that the number of takeoffs and landings is limited at Heathrow to 480,000 on an annual basis, and we're very, very close to that limit. However, we have seen a slight increase in aircraft size and an increase in load factor, which gives the 2.4% growth in passenger numbers reported on this page. Within the numbers, if you're looking region by region, you can see some interesting differences. And a key driver of two of the numbers on that page is, in fact, the acquisition of BMI by British Airways. BMI was flying short-haul only, and therefore the utilization of those slots was less effective than once British Airways has been able to incorporate it into their network, the network which mixed long-haul and short-haul flights. So therefore, they are operating fuller, and that is a principal driver for that 4.9% growth in Europe. By the way, it's also a driver, to some extent, of the decline in Africa, because some of the routes that BMI were flying no longer flown by British Airways. So there is that one-off effect. If you put that aside, you can see, with the exception of Africa, every single region growing, which is encouraging. And to compare that, as I do quarter by quarter, with our European competitors across Europe, We are constrained on the upside, it's true, but nonetheless you can see from this that we're in the upper half, we're above the midpoint compared to Barajas, to Charles de Gaulle, Frankfurt and to Schiphol. So that's good performance in absolute terms and good performance in relative terms. I'll turn to the CapEx story, the investment story, and T2 is the most visible element within that, not the only element, but the most visible and important one today. T2, the construction is due to complete in November of this year, which means that by now most of the activity, were you to visit today, you'd see is fit out. And also starting up is the testing of systems and procedures towards the 4th of June opening date, when I think it's 5:35 or around about then the first aircraft, United aircraft, will land at the opened terminal. You'll remember Terminal 2 allows all of the Star, substantially all of the Star Alliances airlines to come together with Aer Lingus, Germanwings, and Virgin's Little Red. It's right in the heart of the oldest part of the airport, so a really important step forward to transforming the oldest part into something absolutely efficient, modern, and as we want to have the airport laid out. So an important element in the transfer, in the transformation, ongoing transformation of Heathrow. And that program is on track from a cost and schedule and quality point of view. Less visible but also important, significant investment in baggage systems, particularly improving the connections and the linkages between Terminal 3 and Terminal 5. And in total for the year, $1.4 billion of investment, clearly a very important investment in the future of our airport. That was Terminal 2 in our investment story. Turning to the regulatory settlement, Q6, or the sixth five-year period since privatization. And we were frankly disappointed with the initial proposals that were produced by the CAA. So, of course, we have submitted well-evidenced response to that, pointing out where we think the facts and the judgments are out of line. Two particular areas. One is with respect to the allowed rate of return. We just don't think that our business belongs alongside other completely different businesses such as National Grid, Network Rail. We're arguing, you've made input about the cost of debt, the cost of equity, which is one of the key dimensions. The other dimension, which is important to us, of course, is the pressure on us to reduce operating costs. Of course we have to reduce operating costs. Every business does that, and we've made substantial proposals to reduce costs. Originally, we've increased that in our most recent revised plan. But nonetheless, the proposals from the CAA and indeed from the airlines we considered were over the top. Logically, faced with a rate of return which is less than the fair market rate of return, investors are bound to wish to reduce the investment rather than increase it. So hardly surprising was the requirement on me to reduce the investment. Of course, we're responsible operators. £2 billion is a responsible level for keeping the airport operating safely, correctly. Nonetheless, it would represent a less rapid progress towards the 2030 plan that we have rather well established jointly with the airlines. We want to invest £3 billion. Hence the revised submission we've made just a couple of days ago, which, of course, we will do, provided that there is a fair market return on investment offered by the regulator. The next key step in that is the proposals from the CAA in October the 4th, after which there's a period of consultation. But October is the next key formal date in our process. Finally, I won't dwell very much on the third of our three strategic topics because we discussed them publicly and openly and extensively last week, and that is with respect to our proposals to expand Heathrow. The heart of our argument, number one, is the UK needs a hub. We need a single hub. Actually, we're well aligned with the Mayor of London in that point, and he makes that argument clearly and coherently, and we do as well, in contrast to the arguments coming from Gatwick, which proposes that you can scatter it around. I suggest that history demonstrates that the attempts to make two hubs have always failed in the past in this country and elsewhere and would not succeed in the future. But that's one step in our argument. The second step in our argument is that Heathrow can deliver that more quickly and more cost-effectively than the alternatives. And you have seen it reported last week. Happily take questions on that if you wish, but I won't add to that now. Instead, I will hand over to Jose to take us in more detail through the financial numbers. Thank you.
Thank you, Colin, and thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for coming today. As Colin just highlighted, we have a very strong financial performance in the first half of the year. In this particular slide, you can see the reflection of that both in terms of the P&L, the EBITDA, and also the balance sheet debt and asset base. From the point of view of the EBITDA, clearly the growth of 18% is a very healthy and significant growth, driven mainly by the revenues that you will see in a minute, aeronautical revenues in particular, underpinned by the both the increase in traffic and the tariff increases at the beginning of April 2013. From the point of view of the costs, the picture is also flat, so it's a very consistent picture with our objectives. Although, as you will see a little bit later on, we expect the second half of the year, obviously, to show a bigger increase in terms of year-on-year costs for reasons that I will explain later on. In terms of the debt picture, net debt is coming down by 4.3% at the SP Group level and 4.1% at the holding company level. This is mainly driven by the disposal of Stansted and the resulting use of the proceeds to pay down debt. And obviously, commensurate with that, you can see the reduction in the regulatory asset base as a result of Stansted coming out of the group. Revenue performance clearly is very healthy, driven by the continued aeronautical income growth. There are a number of factors supporting that growth. First of all, obviously, the growth in traffic, which is really good and is leading us to believe that the end of the year we will end up with a total traffic above the original expectations when we published our investor report in December 2012. Of course, also there is the headline increase in tariffs ticking at the beginning of April 2013. This is a combination of the RPI plus the 7.5% real tariff increase that we are allowed to implement every year in Q5. But there is also an element of yield that is relevant. You remember last year we went through a period of time of yield dilution. That means that we were not able to obtain the revenue per passenger that we were allowed to get as part of the regulatory, let's say, construct. We have a cap. We can obtain a maximum amount of revenues per passenger. When we are not able to achieve that because the mix of passengers is different to what we expected, we recover that in subsequent years. So we are starting to recover, first of all, in this year, some of the element of dilution 2 years ago. And secondly, we are experiencing more concentration than dilution. Last year, at this moment in time, last year we went through a period of time of yield dilution. Now we are experiencing yield concentration. So the combination of all those factors is underpinning the aeronautical income growth. From the point of view of the net retail income per passenger, clearly the total net retail income is growing in line with traffic, but on a per passenger basis, the growth is relatively modest, although we have seen that accelerating in the second quarter. In general, all the different categories of the commercial revenues are growing. There is none of them which is underperforming. and it's more down the relatively modest increase in the net retail income per passenger is more down to the passenger mix, because with the higher growth in European traffic, obviously this is less the European traveler is less propense than the long haul traveler to spend in the shops. But even the luxury goods, the luxury brands that you know we mentioned in the last quarter results presentation were somehow going through a period of time of relatively softening, we have seen that improving slightly in the second quarter of the year. Finally, the reduction in other income is something we mentioned already in the previous quarter results presentation. It's down to the change in the way we treat some of the intra-group charges. You will see that reflected in both revenues and costs, general expenses, and as a result of that is totally neutral from the EBITDA and the results point of view. In terms of costs, as I said before, the costs are performing as planned. They are on track. They are basically flat. I have to say there were a number of one-off costs last year, driven by the investment in the Olympics to get ready for the summer. But equally, this first half of 2013, we have been spending in restructuring some of our operations, some of our as well as central services. So this is the costs incurred that it will drive efficiencies in the coming years. So this is part of the plan to start obtaining efficiencies that we will take advantage of over Q6. We will carry on doing these kind of things in the second half of the year, of course. The remaining employment cost, as you can see, the employment cost is the category which is growing more, is driven by a non-cash pension service charge that probably will also continue impacting the cost figure over the rest of the year, but once again with no impact whatsoever in cash. And the general expenses, as I mentioned before, this is the offsetting element to the revenue that I mentioned before in connection with the intercompany charges. So I have to say the second half of the year you would expect we expect to see growth in the total cost. To start with, we will continue investing in restructuring the business and getting the business fit for Q6. We will also start spending in the pre-opening or the operational readiness of Terminal 2. As Terminal 2 is getting into the operational readiness mode, obviously we have a number of teams, people, activities around that will involve additional costs in the second half of the year. The combination of the healthy revenue growth and flat cost, obviously, is once again delivering a very consistent EBITDA growth, 19.5% CAGR over the last 5 years. I have to reiterate the message that we consistently put forward, which is the reason for that EBITDA. This is an EBITDA which is supporting and underpinning our investment program to transform the airport. And when I say underpinning the investment program, I mean the future, but also the past, and that's very important because we have been investing £11 billion in the airport over the last two quinquennia, and obviously we expect that particular investment to also be properly remunerated. Taking a look at the traditional reconciliation between interest payable and interest paid, as I always mention, the figures circling in green are headline figures that you can see in the P&L. The red, the ones circling red are those that we want to bring to your attention. Basically, to make a long story short, to move from the interest payable and the headline interest payable figure in the income statement to the underlying net interest payable, the most relevant adjustment is the adjustment for the fair value of the derivative portfolio, the mark-to-market of the derivative portfolio. The chief element there is the index-linked swap portfolio valuation. In this particular case, there is a negative impact in the P&L. If you remember, the change in inflation expectations at the beginning of the year, right after the Office of National Statistics confirmed that there were no changes in the RPI calculation, so that brought the inflation expectations back up, and as a result we have this particular negative P&L impact. It was positive in the last quarter of last year. And then the conclusion is that the total external debt interest payable is £364 million, including internal and external is £391 million, very much in line with the previous year. The next adjustment is just basically the accretion of index-linked instruments, which is at more than £160 million in total out of the £96 million there. We have to adjust that because obviously this is not is a non-cash element. The picture is one of £295 million of cash outflow, out of which 268 is related to external debt. Significant increase year on year. Basically, this is just a timing, phasing thing, because in the first half of this year, we ended up paying coupons, around £100 million in coupons from bonds that were issued where we entered into at the beginning of last year. So this is mainly a timing thing. Clearly, from the point of view of the leverage, pretty consistent picture, very much in line with our expectations and the commitments we have in terms of maximum gearing levels. There is definitely still a significant headroom there. The impact of the sale of Stansted, as I mentioned before, impacted both debt and RAB, but overall it represented a positive deleveraging impact over the whole picture. In terms of the net debt movement between the end of 2012 and the end of June 2013, the main components, obviously the most relevant figure there is the £1.4 million of the net Stansted disposal proceeds that was already presented in the first quarter, and of course the capital expenditure. You can see the capital expenditure figure is clearly higher than the normal figure you have seen in the past. This year is one year of particularly intensive capital investment. Colin mentioned we are on track to invest £1.4 billion in total. We continue funding a significant part of that through internally generated cash flows. In terms of the net restricted payments, the only addition to the figure in the first quarter is just the regular quarterly payment of the dividend. We have paid £64 million in dividends in the second quarter of the year, consistent with a plan to make four equal payments quarter by quarter. So, by way of conclusion, really good quarter and half year. We are particularly proud of the record passenger satisfaction, despite the fact that obviously we have higher passenger numbers. So, growing passenger numbers, but still delivering excellent service to the passenger. The EBITDA growth as a result of that, I want to reiterate once more, is the key underpinning of our not only future but also historical investment in Heathrow transformation. Terminal 2 progressing well, on track to open in June next year. As Colin said, very importantly, we are contesting and really challenging the CAA's proposal for Q6. We have presented the three options for a third runway at Heathrow. In all the cases, we believe we can deliver more efficient, more effective, cheaper and quicker than any other alternative. And finally, you wouldn't be surprised that as a result of the trading, record or the trading experience over the last months and our expectations for the summer, we believe that we will exceed the full year revenue and EBITDA guidance that we provided some time ago in the last investor report. So we are on track to exceed our expectations a couple of months ago. Thank you very much, and now we open the Q&A session.
Thank you very much, Jose, and we'll take some questions, perhaps starting in the room and subsequently online. There's a microphone arriving just from behind. Do, by all means, introduce yourself so people know who's asking the question.
That's Adrian Fourcade from Deutsche Bank. So basically, I have two questions. First, on the regulatory front, you've submitted a revised plan with $2 billion of capex, and given all the noise made by airlines, I was wondering whether this revised plan might not, in the end up as the one which will be selected, so that there will be some face saving. And wouldn't that allow you as well to get maybe a slightly higher WACC? And finally, on the funding side, what are your plans for the next 12 months, please?
I'll leave Jose to respond on finance and then pick up the question. Actually, we've made two submissions to the CAA quite soon after the initial proposals. We made our response to that, and that included the inevitable consequence of less investment if the allowed rate of return was at the level proposed. Just a couple of days ago, we submitted an alternative business plan that reverts to $3 billion on the basis of an adequate return on capital. So actually, there are two submissions in front of the CAA. And, actually, it's not just a question, it's not a question of arm wrestling, it's a straightforward question of whether the regulator does their job of incentivizing investment, in which case $3 billion is there, or discouraging investment, in which case it would be lower. Actually, it would be a lot lower if it wasn't for the fact that clearly we have obligations to run the airport responsibly, safely, and so on. So, really, there are those two plans out there, and we very much hope that we will end up in a position that allows us to deliver the $3 billion plan.
Well, from the point of view of the issuance activity, clearly the first half of the year has been a very particular one. First of all, after the sale of Stansted, obviously we ended up in a liquidity position that made less relevant to be in the market. Secondly, obviously going through the process of CAA putting forward the initial proposals, it was not the best time to really be in the market until we can see some clarity about it. But definitely we believe that it is likely to be the case that in the coming months we will contemplate funding activity, obviously provided market conditions are right. And the good thing is that at this minute we are not, if you like, under pressure. Our liquidity position is strong. We can carry on without issuing. But of course, we mentioned a number of times, we want to be, actively coming back to the market if and when it is appropriate. So, in principle, I would like to see us coming back to the market in the coming months if and when the conditions are right.
Thanks, Adrian. Other questions in the room? One just in front and a second one too, so a third one up.
Michael Posnansky from MG. When we look at post-T2, what should we expect on the operating cost front for the airport as a whole?
Well, I don't have here detailed information, but definitely T2 opening will involve, obviously, extra costs in the quinquennium. So, that it will be a rebate in terms of the cost. Opening a new terminal is always involving a more costly operation, definitely. And this is a very interesting conundrum, because some people would be led to believe, in that case, why do you open new terminals? What is the benefit? Well, the benefit is twofold. First of all, of course, you have a better passenger experience, and as a result of that, you will become more competitive, because passengers, in the end, are the reason to leave for us and the airlines. But secondly, and very importantly, there are significant savings in the airline's operation as a result of working in a much more state-of-the-art and more efficient terminal. I mean, for example, say British Airways, made no secret of the fact that in Terminal 5 they are operating and capable of saving tens of millions of pounds, because the operation is more efficient, the baggage systems are more efficient. So in our war, and this is something we are very keen to make the point to the airlines, to the regulator, in our war, sometimes more state-of-the-art, better facilities doesn't necessarily involve a reduction in operating cost, this side of the fence, but the other side of the fence. And of course, I will be more than happy to share with you the detailed information about the impact of Terminal 2 in Q6. I don't have now the figure off the top of my head, but clearly it's rebasing the operating cost element.
Thank you.
I think there was another question just in the row ahead, if you pass the microphone over. Thank you very much.
Yeah, good afternoon. It's Miguel Medina from JB Capital. Just two questions. The first one, it's also on OPEX. I think there is a large difference with the new submission you have made to the CAA. You are able to achieve significantly higher operating OPEX savings in Q6. Can you comment on what the main drivers are for that revised figure? And then the second question, a very general one, you mentioned during your presentation that you were clearly in favor of a large hub in the southeast, in the London area. You were opposed to what you call the scattered approach of Gatwick. Would you maintain the same position if, as a result of that scattered approach, Heathrow could become a deregulated airport? If the regulator assumed that there was enough competition because of this scattered approach, and then therefore you were not subject to, you know, the current regulatory regime?
Well, the scattered approach simply doesn't reflect the economics of airlines. Tokyo tried it about 30 years ago, and as a result, they handed their lunch to South Korea. Tokyo was the main hub in Asia. It's now Incheon. Haneda was, and it's now Incheon. So I don't think your question sets up a false logic if someone chooses. But that alternative model simply doesn't work, because the business that gets spilt out of Heathrow doesn't go to Gatwick or Stansted. It goes to Paris or Amsterdam. And if you want some evidence of that, why is Stansted half full today when the landing charges are less? The answer is because airlines, long-haul airlines, make more money than Heathrow. And they do that because they can fill the aircraft. They can fill the aircraft because although demand from London is highly variable, higher on Sunday night than it is on Wednesday night, they can offset that with transfer traffic, which is elastic. You can't do that at Stansted. You can't do that at Gatwick. And you won't do it nearly as efficiently if you split the transfer activity between two different hubs. And the point there is that passengers have always got a choice. And the Amsterdam choice is going to look better if you undermine the Heathrow case relatively. And therefore, scattering, spreading the hub activity around is simply handing the UK's economic lunch to Holland and France and Germany. On the cost point, Jose, do you want to respond?
Well, definitely there is a combination of different things, but probably the most relevant one is the cost of maintaining and operating the baggage systems across the airport. This is the main contributor. I have to say there is a very, well, we have been working hard over the last not only months but years in trying to identify and stretch our imagination to deliver operating cost savings. As Colin said, we are conscious that we have to be more efficient. Everyone has to be more efficient. But we want to be realistic in our proposal. In the previous version of the plan, we were still working on some contractual arrangements that we couldn't bank on, and we are now capable of doing that. Baggage maintenance and operation is probably the most significant of them, where we are achieving significant savings with regard to the previous status quo. But to be honest, you cannot say one single thing. It's a combination of things, utilities, different activities across the airport.
Thank you very much. Should we... Sorry, there's another hand, two rows back.
Jakob Botman, Siemens Bank. Thank you for the good presentation. Two short questions. The recent incident with the Ethiopian Airlines Dreamliner. I know this caused cancellations roughly stretching over 2 days of flight operations. Also, it was only, I think, a runway closure of 90 minutes. We all know your capacity constraints, of course, and I would be interested just to get a little bit more color and idea from a credit perspective. Do such incidents like this one, top line, bottom line, is there any repercussion, a significant repercussion or not significant? And second, if there are such incidents, similar incidents, how works the burden sharing with the airlines? Meaning, is a compensation to passengers and other costs or income lost? Is this which percentage is up to the airlines and to which extent you are impacted?
Thanks for the question. Let me just kick off with some data. The categorization of the two runways was reduced for 50 minutes for short-haul aircraft and 70 minutes for long-haul. So that's how long there was direct restriction on aircraft moving. In an hour on average, say, in an average hour, we move 80 aircraft. So that's 80 aircraft that would have landed and taken off and didn't. And that amount of disruption inevitably spreads for the rest of the day and indeed somewhat into the following day. So that is a consequence. If we were operating at 50% of capacity, we could recover those 80 in the next hour. We're not. We're at 99%, so it takes us a considerable amount of time to recover from that. In terms of burden sharing, if less passengers land, we make less revenue. But for passenger disruption, the first responsibility is towards airlines for compensating if there are cancellations. But I think, you know, those passengers, the majority, would have flown that afternoon or the next day, albeit somewhat disrupted. So I think if you look historically at Heathrow, this is one of our arguments with the regulator, you can see that over a 10-year period on average, there are a certain number of days that are disrupted by high winds, volcano events, and that has an impact on Heathrow, and you need to make sure the regulatory settlement reflects that reality, both in terms of the average and the volatility. And of course, we're limited in our ability to grow, so therefore we're hit on the downside. We don't necessarily get the all of the bounce back.
On the comment on credit,
the impact financially has been negligible, to be honest, because in our case, those passengers end up flying, so basically it's irrelevant. So it's more the disruption, of course, than the financial impact.
We might switch to the conference call operator if you want to, if you would invite any questions from the line.
Thank you. Telephone participants, if you would like to ask a question, please press 01 on your telephone keypad now. You can press 02 to withdraw your questions any time. And our first question comes from the line of Luis Prieto of Deutsche Bank. Please go ahead. Your line is now open.
Good afternoon, Luis Prieto from Deutsche Bank. My other questions have been answered. I just had a very brief one. You talked about exceeding the target for the full year. Could you give us an idea of by how much, but to what extent, and when would you expect to officially upgrade the guidance? Is that Q3 results, next investor report? Thank you.
To be honest, we will exceed slightly the figures, so I wouldn't like to be more precise, but nothing terribly material. On the other hand, the reason why we are not providing any more precise guidance is because at this minute we are working on the new traffic forecasting and we are pulling together all this data. And without that work internally finished, I don't want to commit beyond that. But to be honest, nothing really extremely material.
fair enough. Thank you.
Our next question comes from the line of Peter Winning of Aberdeen Asset Management. Ed, your line is now open.
Hello there. I've got a question on the regulations in the tariffs in Q6. I mean, it looks like the tariffs are going to be a lot less favourable, whatever happens. What's your view on your target dividend in Q6, given that some of your credit metrics would probably suffer if the tariffs are less favourable? So, for example, your FFO and your ICR metrics and your debt to RAB metrics would suffer. Are you preparing to lower dividends to compensate that?
I think it is premature to say anything about dividends. Our policy remains the same, which is to continue paying regular, stable and increasing dividends year on year. Nothing has changed. Of course, the regulatory discussion is relevant to dividends as it is relevant to many other things. But I think it's early days. We need to wait and see, because we are of the view that equity can be, when equity doesn't get the right return, sooner or later the equity will find ways of obviously mitigating that. One of them is reducing, for example, the level of investment and risks. So we are still hopeful that there will be a sensible outcome out of these Q6 discussions.
Okay, so there's been no decision on how the dividend would be affected then. That will be after the final tariffs are decided.
For the time being, we are working on the assumption that the outcome will be capable of dealing with, as I said before, a consistent, increasing and stable dividend policy, which is what we have been trying to basically target.
Okay, thanks.
Our next question comes from the line of James Sparrow of BNP Paribas. Please go ahead. Your line is now open.
Yes, hi, good afternoon. Just one sort of big picture question, really. Just looking at the plans for the third runway, some big numbers here, sort of 14 to 18 billion, which is more than your current RAB. I just wondered if you could sort of talk conceptually about how you'd be able to fund that within the existing debt platform. Thanks.
Well, I think, to be honest, it is early days. I mean, in our submission, we have made clear that, first of all, this is a long-term investment. It will take a good number of years, up to 15 years, if we consider both the step one, which is to be able to get to 100 million passengers per annum, and the step two, which is up to 130 million passengers per annum. Secondly, we have made no secret of the fact that there are elements of that investment which are not strictly speaking related to the airport infrastructure. They are related to the surface access or potentially compensations to residents that may need to be supported by some sort of public, funding. So all those elements have to be contemplated as we move forward in this discussion. And thirdly, I think, of course, we will need to see what is the appropriate regulatory, construct to deal with that. I'm of the view that the existing regulatory framework based on RAV is fine, is fit for purpose, and will be, in principle, capable of dealing with this particular kind of investment, but we may need to discuss with the regulator some adjustments to that. I mean, it is early days. It's not about changing the framework, it's about refining the framework to make it consistent with a level of investment which is unprecedented. It's absolutely clear that this level of investment hasn't been addressed before. But I still believe that the airport infrastructure will be capable of being financed and funded by us privately under the current regulatory framework.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, James.
Our next question comes from the line of Juan Carlos Calvo of Banco Espirito Santo. Please go ahead. Your line is now open.
Hi, good afternoon. I have a question related to the after the sale of the Stansted Airport. I understand from previous conference calls that one of the options was to use part of the proceeds to upstream to the shareholders. I was wondering whether that's still part of the part of your thoughts and where you are in that sense. Thank you.
Well, actually, that has been completed as planned. Basically, if you remember, the objective was to be able to return to shareholders the equity element. What we assessed was the equity element of the Stansted airport after the disposal. So as a result of that, we ended up paying a £300 million dividend to the ultimate shareholders. That has been after the end of June. That took place at the beginning of July. And this is the special dividend we have paid this year in connection with the Stansted equity. Obviously, that has nothing to do with Heathrow's future or ongoing funding needs.
So if I understand you correctly, €300 million has been distributed to the shareholders this month of July.
£300 million.
Sorry. And this month of July, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Our next question comes from the line of Nick McDonald of Barclays. Please go ahead. Your line is now open.
Hi, good afternoon. Just given your earlier comments with regards to coming to the bond market in the coming months, and your track record over recent years of tapping new bond markets, do you have any plans with regards to your potential issuing currency?
To be honest, it's early days. I mean, of course, we keep an eye on relative value, but also we don't forget that the sterling market is also a core market to us. So I think we will explore all the possibilities. I cannot tell you now it's going to be any particular market. I don't know, Andrew, if you want to add anything else more.
No, I think you've hit the nail on the head. We always keep our options open until we're much closer to launching a transaction.
I just wanted to clarify that the £300 million in dividends relating to Stansted were already out of the ring fence in the first quarter. So this is a transaction that took place in July, but the cash was already upstream out of the ring fence right after the disposal of Stansted. So that is not impacting or involving any cash upstream in the second quarter of the year out of the SP group.
Okay, thank you.
Just to remind all telephone participants, if you would like to ask a question, please press 01 on your telephone keypad now.
I take that as an indication that there were no more questions in the queue externally. Just while people on the line consider that, anyone in the room wish to ask a question? I don't see anything. A final opportunity. Oh, yes, there is. Jakob? The microphone is just on the way. That'll help people on the telephone line.
Maybe a general one on the third runway discussion. Now, Gatwick came out also with some detailed plans and costs on their second runway option. And of course, we all do not have the crystal ball. But at least myself and maybe others are highly interested. What is your gut feeling on where this will end, and why do you think you are best positioned to get the go ahead from the public domain? And if not, is there a plan B, possibly, for Heathrow? I know that's a very difficult and general topic, but any comments are appreciated.
Well, I think our argument, I would say, is politically inconvenient, because our argument is that for a hub to be effective, you need to have one, you can't have two. Twice in history, we've tried to make a second hub in Gatwick. Both of those attempts fail. I've referred to the split hub in Tokyo, which had the predicted consequences there. You can look at other attempts, Montreal, to build a new airport and then shut it again because the passengers didn't want to use it. So I think there's good evidence that our slightly inconvenient answer, that you have to have a single hub to bring all the passengers to one place, is in fact true. You can look at some evidence for that if you like. You can look at the value of slots at Heathrow compared to other airports, which would give you a hint. You can look at the fact that Stansted's half empty, which might give you a hint. You might conclude from that that if you spill business from Heathrow, that it spills to Frankfurt, to Holland, to Paris, which is why those countries are always so happy when the UK consistently backs off from addressing this, the need. But you can form your own view on that. Gatwick is arguing otherwise. Interesting that Gatwick argue on a competition basis. It's a funny form of competition where you say we want to compete, and the way to do that is to prevent our competitor adding capacity, i.e. tie our competitor's hands and allow us to proceed. I don't think that's a very obviously good definition of competition, but if it suits you, by all means, you can use that argument. I don't think it's a valid one. So economically, I think Heathrow is the best solution because it provides hub capacity, and hub capacity is what needed, and because we can do it quicker at Heathrow than a brand new facility elsewhere. The fact that it's economically viable, though, isn't enough. It has to be politically deliverable as well. And, you know, that remains to be seen. That's a big hurdle. Equally, I think a proposal which is politically convenient but economically impossible, I don't think that's going to happen. Perhaps you think otherwise. You know, those are the arguments we laid out last week. It's, I think it's good that we have an independent body taking a data-driven look at it. Sir Howard Davis Airport Commission is doing so. I think they're doing the job seriously, as far as I can tell, gathering the data and looking at it diligently and carefully. So I'm reasonably confident they'll produce a good answer. Whether ultimately there is the political will to deliver will be a tough challenge for whichever government is in place at the time to face up to. Any other questions in the room or on the line? If not, I suggest we wrap it there, and I thank you very much indeed, as ever, for your interest in Heathrow and for coming this afternoon. Thank you very much.
This now concludes our telephone call. Participants, you may disconnect your lines.